This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 2 weeks ago, New Yorker Kim Braithwaite experienced a parent's nightmare. That Saturday night, the single mother had to go to work or risk losing the job that supported her family, but the babysitter didn't show up. In the end, she decided to leave her kids, 1 and 9, home alone. Late that night, somebody torched the apartment building. When she got home from work, Kim Braithwaite learned that both her children died in the fire. Shortly after that, she was arrested for reckless endangerment. A lot of parents face similar decisions every day. According to one new survey, over 3 million children are left alone for some part of the day on a regular basis. Of course, circumstances vary, and the results are rarely so tragic, but the case raises a number of issues. In the next few minutes, we're going to explore the legal implications. Does the law establish when it's okay to leave kids alone and when it's not? And we'll take a closer look at the research about how many kids are home alone, how often, and why. But we also want to talk about the decision, which is never easy. How do you know when your child is ready to be left home alone? What factors do you need to take into account? What rules should there be? And what do you do when your child care arrangements fall through? Whether you're a parent or a kid, call and tell us about leaving and being left alone. Our numbers here in Washington are 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us at totn@npr.org. And joining us to talk about parental liability is Martin Guggenheim, a professor of family law at New York University. He's with us from his office in Manhattan, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The mother in this case is facing up to 16 years in prison if she's convicted of reckless endangerment. It seems awfully harsh given what's already happened to her, but is that the law in New York?
Well, the law in New York permits the district attorney to seek a prosecution and an indictment, because the statute merely says that people may not recklessly endanger a child's life.
Does it define that in terms of, you know, it's okay to leave a 10-year-old at home but not a 9-year-old?
No, and we would be far better off if there was such a definition in all kinds of ways, but New York's law does not have such a definition.
So by that definition, then, such prosecutions would be arbitrary.
Well, yes, they could be considered to be arbitrary. They also do not well serve society's interests, I think.
Mm-hmm. What about the situation in other states? Is there a similar kind of ambiguity?
Yes. I know of no state that has a specific law that sets an age limit below which it is impermissible, a violation of law, to leave children alone.
Is there any background to inform these decisions? I mean, if prosecutors or judges wanted to read up on this, I mean, how did legislatures arrive at this rather nebulous area, or not arrive, as the case may be?
Well, you know, on your program today, you're going to explore with people from around the country their own experiences. That's a wonderful way to begin the exploration. I think what we'll find is it will be difficult to achieve a consensus of what is the minimum age. The legislature has never attempted, to my knowledge, in any state to make such an inquiry, and one could understand its reluctance to do so. If it chose to set an age that was on the high side, to be conservative, there's a danger that people would not consider the rule or the law to be very wise or sensible, and that would cause a disrespect for law. If it set the age at a very low level, a number, so that all would agree you don't leave 3-year-olds home alone, for example, the problem would be that some would consider that an invitation to leave children just a little above that low number alone, and no one wants to invite that either.
Now, I read of a couple of cases, you know, not all that dissimilar from Ms. Braithwaite's dilemma, in which, you know, something awful happened, and then grand juries declined to indict.
The question before a grand jury, which is the body from the community that decides whether the act is criminal in the first place to warrant a trial, or the petit jury during a trial deciding whether someone is guilty, is answering the question you asked about that the legislature could imaginably ask itself. Mm-hmm. Does this act constitute child endangerment? And in the cases you're referring to, the grand jury thought no, and the prosecutor felt that he or she discharged responsibility by bringing it to a grand jury's attention. Maybe that's all that'll happen in the New York case.
Yeah. Now, given the fact that the endangerment is the act of leaving them alone, it's not the terrible fate that befell them, so given the fact that we're going to take a better look at the statistics in just a moment, but millions of kids are left alone every day, so picking out one case where something awful happened, isn't that selective prosecution?
Well, it may be seen as selective in prosecution. Let me stress that it's foolish prosecution. The one person in New York City who lost the most as a consequence of these children's death is now the defendant in the criminal case. That really doesn't make a great deal of sense. She's mourning. She's feeling awful, and I'm assuming that she's a wonderful parent who made a difficult decision under difficult circumstances and may even have made the wrong decision. But that doesn't mean she committed a crime when New York State hasn't seen fit to make clear that the choice she made was criminal before she made it. Hmm. Good criminal law statutes are created precisely to tell people how to conform their conduct to the law. New York hasn't done that.
And from what you said, neither have other states.
And neither have other states.
Martin Guggenheim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Martin Guggenheim is a professor of family law at New York University, and he spoke with us from his office there. And the case in New York, indeed tragic, and far from the norm. Millions of parents leave their kids home alone, even for short times, every day, and nothing terrible ever happens. To tell us more about who these unsupervised kids are, we're joined by Catherine Tout of Child Trends, which is a nonprofit research organization based here in Washington, D.C. She's the co-author of a report called Left Unsupervised, A Look at the Most Vulnerable Children, which was published last April. And Catherine Tout joins us today on the phone from Minneapolis, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
That figure cited earlier in the program, 3 million kids left unsupervised on a regular basis. Who are they?
Well, we're talking about school-age children. Those are 6 to 12-year-olds, and they're either spending time alone or they're with a sibling under the age of 13. And these are children both whose parents are employed and some whose parents are not employed. They're children under a wide range of circumstances.
They are what we came to call latchkey children some time ago.
Right. On average, they're spending only about 5 hours a week unsupervised, though there is a small proportion of children who are spending more than 10 hours a week unsupervised. But in general, these children aren't spending extensive time unsupervised, and many of them also have another supervised arrangement that they're in each week, like an after-school program or going to grandma's house after school.
Mm-hmm. Now, your survey uses the term self-care. What's that terminology mean?
Well, we use that to refer to children who are spending time unsupervised, either alone or they could be in the presence of a young sibling, so a sibling under the age of 13.
Now, you begin this study at 6 on the, I guess, presumption that no kid under 6 is left unsupervised.
We do actually know from the survey that a very small proportion of 5-year-olds are also left unsupervised, but it's very, very small, maybe 1%.
Now, in the case in New York that we've been talking about, the mother had to go to work. Is that typical of why parents would decide to leave their children without adult supervision?
Well, actually, our survey captures the use of regular self-care. So in the case that we're talking about in New York, that was a case where an arrangement fell through.
Mm-hmm.
But we looked at self-care that happens every week on a regular basis, and certainly employment is one reason, maybe filling the gaps between the time that a child gets home from school or from their after-school activity and the time that a parent comes home. But there are some other factors that are linked to the use of self-care, and for sure, because of this, it's only 15% of children nationwide. Not every parent who's employed is leaving their children alone each week.
But this would typically be children of either single parents or where both parents are working?
In fact, it's both. And we also found something that's surprising, and we've seen it in other surveys as well, that, in fact, children from higher-income families are more likely to be left unsupervised each week than children in low-income families.
That seems counterintuitive.
I think it is counterintuitive, but if you think more about where children from low-income families might be living, it makes a little more sense. I think we know that parents are concerned. They take into account many factors, including the children's maturity, of course, but also the safety of their neighborhood and the availability of other neighbors to be around in case something happens. So if we think about a low-income neighborhood, it makes sense that a parent there might feel more concerned than a parent in a higher-income neighborhood.
Now, there are also these, again, it's always the outrageous cases or the tragic cases that make the headlines. But the story of the woman who left five children unsupervised while going off on vacation with her boyfriend, that's atypical, at least according to your study.
Absolutely. But again, we didn't study those arrangements where it just happens occasionally or where a child care arrangement has fallen through. We looked at something that was happening every week. And it's certainly the biggest predictor of the use of self-care is age. So as children get older, a six-year-old is much less likely to be left unsupervised than a 12-year-old, for example.
And what about the increased risk for children who are left home alone? Did the survey test for that?
No, we don't explicitly test for that. We know from other surveys and other research that for children who begin self-care very young, they are more at risk for school problems and social problems, and same for low-income children. And it's basically a case of the good things not being able to happen, like being involved in after-school programs or exercising, and increasing the risk for bad things, for example, accidents or injuries, or hanging out with other unsupervised kids. And for young children who kind of start a course of spending time alone early on, they may be more resistant later on to spending time in an after-school program. So we're concerned. Those are the two groups that we called the vulnerable children that we are most concerned about the risks of self-care.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Megan, who's with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi.
I just have a quick comment about when I was a child. I'm now 20 years old. And when I was 10, my mother had a child. And at about age 12 to 13, she would start letting me babysit him when I have three other brothers that are older. When they had basketball or soccer games, or when my parents couldn't be home.
Mm-hmm.
And I, at that age, even now, looking back, felt completely competent to look after a young child. But now that he is 10, my brother, I don't even feel comfortable leaving him home alone, let alone with another child. So I definitely think that this is something that needs to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. And I also think the issue of what age a child should be left home alone is not nearly as important as why isn't our government doing something to provide places for these children to go so that their parents can work and can provide a stable environment for these children to spend time in when their parents can't look after them?
Well, Catherine Tout, I'm not sure that was affordability of child care options, was that part of your survey at all?
That was not part of our survey, but that is absolutely, it's one of the most important issues, I think, affordability and availability of programs for children, and I think the point about individual children, some children as at 12 may not be at all competent to stay alone, whereas a 10-year-old certainly would be able to do that for an hour. So I think that the point about the individual needs of the child and of the family being taken into account is important.
Megan, thanks very much for the call. Good point.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And Catherine Tout, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Catherine Tout is the co-author of Left Unsupervised, A Look at the Most Vulnerable Children, a report published last April by Child Trends, a Washington-based nonprofit research organization. She was with us on the phone from Minneapolis. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk about when parents know how to leave their kids home alone, when it's time, and what rules they might want to set up. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later in the program, why the Pentagon decided to ban media coverage of coffins coming home from Iraq. Right now, we're talking about kids who are left home without adult supervision and how parents know when their children are ready to fly solo. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us is child psychologist Lawrence Steinberg. He teaches at Temple University and has written many books on child psychology. His new one due out next year is The 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting. And Lawrence Steinberg joins us on the phone from his home outside of Philadelphia. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks. How do we know when a child is ready to be left home alone?
Well, I don't think there's a simple cut and dried answer because it depends on the child and on the home. I think some rough guidelines might be that elementary school children, for the most part, are not ready, that middle school children may be ready, and that high school children certainly are ready. And when I say that middle school children may be ready, there I think the issue for parents is to look at their individual child and at whatever the demands might be on that child staying home alone and make a decision based on that.
We wanted to give all of you an opportunity to talk with us about this issue, so let's go right to the phones. And Tom joins us on the line from Syracuse in New York.
Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. I have four kids, and each is very different from the others. And they're all old enough to do it now. The youngest is 11. But that has varied quite a bit. I had one daughter who really wasn't ready until she was 13. Another, my son, was really ready when he was 9. A lot of that has to do with how do you set it up. It's not something where one day you decide the kid's going to stay home. You know, we broke it to them over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Supervised environment, and then maybe an hour alone, then maybe once or twice a week alone, and now they function very, very well until mom gets home, which is usually an hour to 2 hours every day.
Tom, I was just wondering, did birth order have anything to do with it? Was the oldest ready earliest?
No, quite the opposite. The oldest was the least ready because she didn't have the experience of watching how other kids did it.
Hmm. Lawrence Steinberg, I get a comment from you?
Well, I think that this parent has put his finger on all of the main points. First, that children differ from each other even when they're the same chronological age and even if they're in the same family. Second, that a lot of it depends on how you set up the situation. And third, that it's best to introduce self-care gradually by almost experimenting and seeing in small increments whether your child can handle the situation.
What kind of increments, Tom? Did you have any tests or what did you look for?
Well, of course, they needed to be able to know their address, how to use the telephone, how to read a telephone number to know where mom and dad are if there was an emergency, and then also their level of comfort. We ask. We have the luxury of being able to ask. A lot of parents don't. A lot of parents are forced into making these decisions because it's either buy the kid food or buy the kid a babysitter.
Sure.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that the issues for kids at the younger end of the age range we're talking about, let's say 9-10-year-olds, are likely to revolve around comfort, being able to handle emergencies, their level of fear or anxiety. The issues for older kids, let's say toward the later years of middle school or junior high school, are those plus questions about their likelihood of involvement in risky or problem behavior, which should be a concern to parents who are leaving pre-adolescents and young adolescents home alone.
Absolutely. I mean, it has to be taken in the context of how the child is being parented all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Tom. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
The phone call.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, is technology affecting this at all? I mean, we now have much more prevalence of, not only computers, which are another electronic device in the home, but beepers and cell phones. So parents are much more available if their children do know how to use the phone.
Sure, and that's a very good thing because some of the research that we've done on this indicates that parents can monitor their kids from work by calling in once or even more frequently during the afternoon by having their child reach them. And so the more ways that you can get in touch with your child and that your child can get in touch with you, the easier it is for you to set up a situation and monitor the situation so that your child is comfortable and stays out of trouble.
Let's go now to Kevin, who's with us from Elk Grove in California.
Hi there. When I was 14 or 15, and I had a sister who was 13 or 14, a year younger than I was, and my parents would allow us to babysit our two younger brothers. And we lived way out in the country. And one evening they went out to a dinner party, and I had my youngest brother, who was 4 or 5, on the back of my bicycle, and he got his foot caught in the spokes, and it ripped a huge hole in his ankle.
Ah.
Just a nasty thing. And so my sister and I pulled him off the bike, carried him into the house. I couldn't stand to look at it, so my sister took care of taking care of him, and I got on the phone, and I had a list of numbers. Our parents had prepared us very carefully for this. Called around, found a neighbor who could come pick us up and take us to the doctor's office, called the doctor's office so that they were ready and waiting for us, and then called my parents and told them what was going on and where we were going. And they met us at the doctor's office, and my youngest brother ended up just fine. I'm trembling right now because it was awfully traumatic.
I bet. I mean, it's not only what's happened to your brother, but you have to at least feel a little bit like it's your fault. And oh my gosh,
yeah.
What do I do now?
Yeah, it was my bike, and I had him on the back of it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So I felt very much still do responsible.
Right, and what is interesting though is that, you know, the combination of a 14-year-old and a 13-year-old probably provided enough judgment to handle the situation.
Absolutely.
In the thoughtful, calm way that you're describing it, although probably you weren't very calm at the time.
Actually, as I recall, we were both icy cold.
Well, that was great. But now compare that. Imagine that situation where the siblings in charge are 8 and 9 rather than 13
yes.
and 14, and you'll see why I raised that
exactly.
concern about the appropriate age for this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other thing, too, that was sort of interesting was we pulled Kerry off my brother off the bike, and as I said, he had a hole that was like an inch wide and maybe an inch deep in his ankle. It was a horrible wound, and I couldn't stand looking at it. It just horrified me. Robin, my sister, was okay, so she took care of Carrie, and I made the phone calls and organized transportation and all that sort of stuff. So
now,
there was also a really good division of labor there.
I wonder, you know, was there a list of neighbors to call? You lived out? There was
a list of neighbors. We've been told to call neighbors first, the ambulance second if we couldn't find a neighbor, and we had to determine whether or not we needed an ambulance or not. Then call the doctor, and then call them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had this list sitting there, and they always made a point before they go out of, here's the list. If anything goes wrong, here's how to handle it.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin, very much.
Sure.
Okay. That question about rules, Dr. Steinberg, and that's, you know, should there be lists and, you know, be clear about telling kids what to do in terms of answering the phone and answering the door?
Absolutely, and I think you can't be more explicit. You can't be too explicit with kids, even with kids who are 12 and 13. So every parent who's listening who has a child who's home for part of the day alone or in the evenings alone should make sure that in their house there is a list that's posted on the refrigerator or someplace prominent that gives very, very explicit, easy instructions on what to do in case of an emergency.
Let's get another caller. Mary's on the line from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hi.
Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about my experience. I was 4 years old. My mother was pregnant, about to have a baby, and she let me outside to play, and I collected all my friends together, and we went on the other side of the block, and I had a bug about starting or playing with fire, and we were all playing. We all had sticks around the fire, and I got a hold of mine, and I had a little hole in my pant leg, and it caught fire, and we were all running around screaming. No, there were no adults around.
And who was the oldest kid again?
About 6 years old.
Oh.
Because it was during the day, and it was, you know, maybe there were kindergarten kids, but the older kids weren't around. And one kid was a real big kid. He tried to blow it out. He was, you know, I remember that. And then a woman, it was at the house, she opened the window up and screamed, and then a couple of houses down, a man came down and rolled me on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Well, that's just terrifying, Mary. I'm sure it was at the time, and guess what? It is now.
Yeah.
So, one of the things I think in answer to the question you asked earlier about rules is that in addition to having a list of numbers that the child should use in case of an emergency, parents really need to think about the rules that they ought to have for what their child is and is not allowed to do. Now, of course, most parents have told their children not to play with matches, but things like whether the child is allowed to use a toaster oven or whether the child is allowed to cook food on the stove, these are things that you really need to go through with your child because those are the kinds of things that often can lead to very tragic events.
Well, the other thing Mary's phone call raises, though, is the issue of what do you do if you're the neighbor and see a bunch of young children running around unsupervised?
I think you first of all make sure that they're safe. Obviously, if
they're on fire, you put it out. Yeah,
right. And I think that we have obligations to each other as members of a community to let each other know when we're worried about something that's happening to their children.
But do you notify authorities? Do you notify the parents? I guess that's a judgment call too.
I think so. I mean, I think I would start by notifying the parents. And seeing what their reaction is. Many parents often don't know that their kids are off doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
Here's an email we got from Tim in Rochester, Minnesota. When I was 9, not only was I left home alone in my rural South Dakota home, but I was also a regular babysitter for 6- and 7-year-old neighbors. Is it that current 9- to 12-year-olds aren't really given much responsibility on a regular basis and therefore, when put into a crisis responsibility role, are unprepared to do so?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think there's any evidence that psychologically today's, you know, 9- to 12-year-olds are any different than they were when this caller was younger. I think the point, and I think the thing we have to keep in mind is that, you know, thank God, most of the time nothing bad happens. So what we're really talking about in the case of these younger children taking care of younger siblings is. Are the rare events when emergency situations arise. Most of the time, things are, you know, nothing major is going to occur that's going to endanger anybody.
We're speaking with Lawrence Steinberg, a professor of psychology at Temple University. The question is, when do we know when to leave kids home alone? What age is right or what level of maturity is right? And, of course, we're taking your phone calls, 800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller. Kim is with us from Nashville, Tennessee.
Hello.
Hi, Kim. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a kind of a concern, which I've had for quite a while. I went to school to be a teacher, to teach biology to middle school and high school students, and I did not go into that because of all the disciplinary problems in schools and the emphasis of blame on the teachers. And rather than on the parents actually raising the children.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how that sort of thing, where the parents lack the children not being supervised or not being taught how to act among other children, and not having all that contact with people affects the school. You know, how they behave in school, and is there a correlation to the result of misbehavior in school and everything we hear on the news and then the increased lack of supervision of kids.
And let me throw homework into that as well, Lawrence Steinberg.
Well, the research shows that some kids, when left unsupervised, are going to misbehave. And certainly we know that the presence of an adult, whether it's a parent or an after-school program director, is going to deter, you know, problem behavior or misbehavior among kids. So certainly, if there's a chance to have your child in an after-school setting where there are other adults around, that's going to cut down on misbehavior. I don't think that the evidence on homework points to a very clear conclusion as to whether kids are more or less likely to do their homework when they have parents who are supervising versus leaving them alone.
Let's go now to Scott in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You have a great program. I really appreciate listening to it every day.
Thanks. That's kind of you.
I'm calling because I had a situation. I told your screener about 4 or 5 years ago, but now that I think about it, it was actually 7 to 8 years ago, where I had to stay home. And there are some situations where parents just have to stay home with the kids. My daughter was acutely ill, and I called in sick to work because I needed to stay home and nurse her.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day when I arrived at work, they fired me.
Hmm.
So we have a situation in this country where people aren't very supportive business-wise and such for parents who need to be home with their children in crisis situations.
Would the reaction have been the same, Scott, if you'd gone, I'm not feeling well, I can't come in today?
It possibly could have been. This was a situation where, I definitely had some attendance issues, but it wasn't a problem that I could have done anything about.
Mm-hmm.
It was compounded by the fact that I claimed unemployment afterwards, and my former employer contested the unemployment claim.
I see.
It went all the way to an administrative appeals, and I won on the appeal.
Okay, well, let's get back to the
sure.
to the issue, though. Lawrence Steinberg?
Well, I think that this caller raises the broader question of how American society has not responded to the fact that patterns of work and family life have changed. You know, we still are in this dream that things are back in the 1950s, when, in fact, three-quarters of all moms are in the labor force, and that means that we have a very, very strong need for after-school programming for kids in this country that we have ducked. And I think it's important that concerned parents go to their school district, go to their communities, and say, we need good after-school programming for our kids.
Lawrence Steinberg, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Lawrence Steinberg is a professor of psychology at Temple University. His latest book, which is due out next spring, is The 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting. He was with us on the phone from his home outside of Philadelphia. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk about a new Bush administration mandate that bans media coverage of military coffins returning to U.S. bases. We'd like to hear from you if you have a relative in the military or if you're in the military yourself. What do you think about this policy? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Back after a short break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.